Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness. Brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go. You make everything all right. But when I feel like I'm lost, something tells me you're here with me. And I can always find my way when you are here.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by Equine Muscle Massage Therapy by Jan Barson, and she could be reached at 631-862-1402. Tonight's guest is Dr. Eben Alexander III, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number is 888-627-6008, or you can instant message the studio at Signs of Life Radio on AIM. And good evening to you, Bob.
And hello, Fran. And I, as you mentioned, we're really excited about our guest tonight. He has been on the show before quite some time ago, but recently you may have seen him in the news because his new book is coming out on October 23rd. It's getting a lot of publicity.
It's going to shake up the world.
He was on the cover of Newsweek.
Time
Magazine is going to be doing a feature on him, and various other things. So, you know, it's going to go a long way. As you'll discover, Dr. Alexander is a neurosurgeon. He had a very extraordinary near-death experience. So he is going to be doing a lot to change worldview because he's looking at it from both perspectives. And we're also excited because he's going to be presenting at our annual conference, which is coming up very soon, November 10th and 11th, to be exact, in Phoenix, Arizona. And
that's going to be a great time for people to get to meet him, probably before he becomes crazy famous, but... he's going to be at our meet and greet on Friday night. He's going to be signing his books, and he's going to be on the panel, which on Saturday and Sunday is two full days of him giving back his perspective on the five most asked questions about the afterlife. So it is going to be a fabulous time to be there, to be in Arizona. People who can be there should count on being there. We are filling up, though. So there's only a few seats left. If you're making on plans on going, you gotta hurry up and do it. The hotel block has already closed, but there are seats both at the Friday night dinner and the conference.
Yeah, I'm sure there are still rooms. Just the block is closed, right?
The block is closed. Yes. Yeah, so it's your own best negotiation for whatever room is left in that hotel.
Shouldn't be that much of a difference. And of course, there are many hotels very close nearby. You mentioned. The format, briefly, you know, we're going to be addressing, each presenter is going to be addressing a specific question. And these, as you mentioned, are questions that we get asked all the time, and we figured, well, why not have the scientists? And those questions are, how do we know the spirit world exists? Can we visit the spirit world? Where is the spirit world? Can we communicate with the spirit world? And what is the spirit world like?
Right, and each of our presenters has a specialty in the field that responds to the corresponding question. However, in our quest to make the scientists work together and share their knowledge together, we're putting them all up on the stage on a panel and presenting them all with each of the questions, which they will all be asked to answer. And then once they've given their answer, then, of course, the expert in the field will do his presentation. And then, doesn't stop there, we're going to turn it over to the audience. and then the audience is going to have the opportunity to ask these guys their questions.
And each day will end with a certified medium doing a session of spirit communication.
Right, so at the end of Saturday we have Deborah Martin, and at the end of Sunday we have Dave Campbell.
Right, and the other presenters besides Zeb and Alexander, you know, Dr. Julie Beischel, Dr. Claude Swanson, Dr. Stafford Betty, and Lloyd Auerbach. So it's a pretty well-rounded group. Of course, when we ask questions such as, you know, what is the spirit world like? Well, that we felt that was important, and I know Dr. Stafford Betty will be addressing that. It's one thing to believe or know that there's an afterlife. It's another thing, you know, mediums very rarely give any type of a description, you know, or a glimpse of what it might be like in another world. So he has assembled an extensive database of channeled reports and look for commonalities, and he's got a pretty good picture, you know, of what it's like. And, of course, you know, Dr. Beischel has done extensive research with mediums, so certainly she'll be able to address, can we communicate, you know, with the spirit world, because she's seen the evidence, you know, that we can. Claude Swanson is a physicist, and he will be able to address that subject from the perspective of science. And where is the spirit world? Exactly how he'll go about it, we'll see. But he'll be able to bring that into lay terms.
What our listeners need to know, and I know I talk about it a lot, is that our culture was raised with the theory, not a proven thing, but a theory of Newtonian science, and everything was built on the acceptance of Newtonian science as the way things are, but it never provided for explanations of things in the unseen world. And physicists are finding that quantum physics does. So I think that's the light that Dr. Claude Swanson is going to be able to shed upon how we know or where the spirit world is from the perspective of being in the obstructed world here.
Yeah, and of course we've interviewed many scientists and physicists who talk about the nature of light in scientific terms, but then we reflect back and we say, wait a second, we've talked to a lot of spiritual people who talk about this light and the same thing, and then when you add the near-death experiencers and they come back, and what did they see? Well, they describe many of them being totally encompassed by this warm and loving light. And what it boils down to, we hear it again not only from the mediums but from the scientists and from researchers and from the experiences, is that it boils down to a world of compassion and love. And that is the key. And that is the commonality amongst all of these various disciplines of study. And perhaps one day, well, not perhaps, all day we will recognize that it's true.
And that will be the day, because it is all about love and compassion.
We're going to go to our break. When we come back, we were anxious to have our featured guest tonight, Dr. Eben Alexander. So stay with us, and we'll be back in a couple minutes.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you could find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Winbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Winbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.winbridge.org.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide support for families who have suffered the loss of a loved one. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707 or on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
The American Association of Electronic Voice Phenomena has always been international and concerned with more than just EVP. To better serve the public, the AAEVP is now Association Transcommunication, or ATRANSC. Their new website is atransc.org, and their motto is Objective Evidence of Survival. The directors believe people should know that death is not dying, and what we learn now applies to what we will learn hereafter.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
For those just tuning in, our guest tonight is Dr. Evan Alexander III. Our sponsor is Equine Muscle Massage Therapy by Jan Barson, and she can be reached via phone at 631-862-1402.
Bob? As a renowned academic neurosurgeon, Evan Alexander spent 25 years totally immersed in his scientific worldview. He authored or co-authored 150 chapters and papers in peer-reviewed journals. He presented at 200 meetings and conferences around the world. Among many other things, he was instrumental in the development of stereotactic radio surgery. And then his life and career took a complete turnaround in 2008 after his body and brain succumbed to an extremely rare form of meningitis. He fell into a deep coma, and he later awakened with the realization that we are much more than our physical bodies. His new book, soon to be released, is called Proof of Heaven, and Dr. Alexander, we're proud to say, will be presenting at our annual conference next month in Phoenix. You can learn more about Dr. Alexander on his website, lifebeyonddeath.com. Welcome, Dr. Alexander.
Well, thank you, and by the way, it's lifebeyonddeath.net.
Okay. Right. I got it right in the email.
Okay. I'm glad we got that. Life,
okay.
Just the way it sounds, lifebeyonddeath.net. You know, Dr. Alexander, when you first joined us for an interview a while back, you were still writing the book, and I only had the opportunity to read a chapter or two. And now that I've read the book, I was able to sort of step back and review all the components to try to make sense of it. And here I look at you. You were a neurosurgeon with perhaps as much knowledge about the human brain as anyone in the world. I mean, you then succumb to this type of bacterial meningitis that affects one in every 10 million people, and this type also winds up attacking your brain. I mean, your odds of survival on day one in the coma were less than 10%. By day four or five, you had virtually no chance of surviving as any functional human being. And then by day six, you had virtually no chance, and your family was just about upon your doctor's advice to say goodbye, and then you wake up, and you make a complete recovery with a very important message for us all based upon your near-death experience. So when I reflect back, I certainly think that it's very likely that this whole thing was part of a greater plan that was orchestrated by the universe. Do you feel the same way?
Well, I must say that I feel very, very fortunate, very grateful to be back. And it took me a long time to get to that point, the point that you're making, where I started thinking that maybe it did all happen for a reason. My first response when I was coming out of coma, given that the meningitis had been so effective at completely eradicating all my memories of my life before coma, I was simply amazed at this incredibly beautiful world that I had lived in, deep in the middle of coma, a very difficult world to kind of explain, and yet one that was very pure and very hyper-real and filled with meaning and filled with lessons. And yet, by not having any of my prior earthly life in my memory banks as I started to wake up, I was simply blown away by the power of that experience. And then over the next few weeks, there was kind of a layered return of my language and then family memories, and then my neuroscience and neurosurgical training, which I think I probably had completely back within about 4 or 5 weeks. Mm. And it kept telling me, no, this could not have happened, especially as I was clued into parts of my medical record, my scans, realized how sick I was, because it completely violated everything I'd ever learned in academic neurosurgery and all those years in neuroscience about how the brain gives rise to consciousness. And so I was blown away by the experience, but then thought, well, it can't possibly have been so real. I mean, it seemed too real to be real. And so I defaulted to writing it up as a neuroscientific report about what it's like to be in coma. But then after going through 9 hypotheses to try and explain it based on neuroscience, my conclusion was that it could not have happened in my brain. And of course, that completely went against the grain of everything I'd ever known, and yet it was the most sensible conclusion. And I can tell you that it probably took me the better part of 2 years wrestling with that question that you bring up about, did this all happen for a reason? Of course, as a doctor, I wanted to explain it, but then also be able to write a prescription and tell my fellow physicians, you know, how I had come back, how I had miraculously recovered when all my doctors thought there was basically a 2-3% chance of survival and no chance whatsoever of neurologic recovery. How did I recover? And it's taken me a long time to come to any answer of that question. But yes, I think after about 2 years, I would finally agree with you that given the extreme rarity of spontaneous E. coli meningitis in an adult, less than 1 in 10 million, and then the fact that I had a 2% survival chance with no chance of full recovery, and then ended up waking up and having full recovery over probably 4 to 6 weeks, I finally had to conclude that maybe it did happen for a reason. And I would say that, kind of to summarize that, I would now say that in many ways mine was a perfect storm of circumstances to be a neurosurgeon with 25 years in academic neurosurgery, and then to have this extremely rare bacterial meningitis that by all rights should have been fatal and yet was not, and to have this very rich spiritual experience deep inside, that maybe it all did happen for a reason. And I certainly feel that my responsibility, especially when I came to realize the power of what my story was really telling me, and that took several months of analysis. I mean, that was not my first interpretation. My first interpretation was, wow, too real to be real. I need to write this up for other neuroscientists. But then I came to realize with meningitis, I should not have experienced anything. And as the power of that reality hit me, and I realized that I had 20,000 words of Odyssey deep within coma, when I shouldn't have remembered anything at all, that's a story that needs to come out, because it says everything about consciousness and about consciousness being independent of the physical brain. And that's why I wrote the book.
And when you speculated about, when you examined the evidence, I mean, you came to the conclusion that perhaps because your neocortex was not working, that maybe you went deeper in your experience than others before you, because you had nobody really, you didn't know who you were. You were just like a product of the universe. You weren't worried about your relatives because you had no memory of them. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. And, you know, I think that we learn a lot from every one of these experiences. So I would not want to say that, you know, that mine was more or deeper or anything. Although I think the reality is, given a severe meningitis and being in coma for a week on a ventilator with severe brainstem signs, in addition to a loss of all my cortical function, that it is an instructive case, because what it forced me to do, especially due to the nature of the hyperreality in this very rich environment that I found myself in, and these oscillations back and forth between very high function and very low function, and I describe all this in my book, but to me it was a very powerful lesson that told me that all of these other near-death experiences and other mystical experiences and mystical states, and that includes near or what's called shared death experiences, and certainly what people encounter in deep meditation and centering prayer, and I would say even with psychedelic drug experiences, that all of these give us a glimpse of a reality that we need to take seriously. And people say, oh, it's all a hallucination, or oh, it's all a dream, and you don't, you know, why waste time worrying about a dream, because it's all in your mind. And yet, I think the what we see with near-death experiences as a main example is that, in fact, they're not a dream or a hallucination. They're very, very different, and they are a glimpse of a realm that is real. It's not in our brain, and it's not in the physical universe, and yet it is very real. And the consistency of the reports, when you look at spiritually transformative experiences of all types, but certainly those dealing with the afterlife, say near-death experiences, which have mainly been reported over the last 40 to 50 years due to cardiopulmonary resuscitative techniques, but also the afterlife literature going all the way back to the Egyptians, you know, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the ancient Greeks, Plato, then into the, you know, the, say, early religious writings, both in the East and the West, and then through the Middle Ages and into the 19th and 20th centuries. Lots written about the afterlife, and what I came to see, especially after my experience, is the similarities far outweigh the differences, and it is really a profound reality that has been very consistent over at least three millennia, and that is what I think is the powerful reality that people need to acknowledge in trying to assess this.
Now you distinctly experienced several different realms, and you gave them names, you know, such as the gateway and the core, and at the beginning you didn't realize that you can progress from one to the other, and later through the power of thought you realized that you could. But can you describe the three basic realms that you found yourself immersed in?
Yes, Bob. It all seemed to start, you know, as I was looking back on it. And again, with my first awareness deep in coma, I had absolutely no recollection whatsoever of my life on Earth. I knew nothing about humans, about this universe. I had no words. I had no language. The meningitis had been extremely effective, wiping all of that out. And my initial awareness was a very coarse, murky, kind of foamy, bubbling mud underground. I called it the earthworm's eye view. And it, you know, it was a very ugly kind of existence, literally like being underground with roots around me. I had no body awareness at all. There was a pounding mechanical sound deep down in the muck, and it seemed to go forever. Since I had no recollection of any existence before that, it really seemed, I mean, centuries, millions of years, I don't know, it seemed to go for a very, very long time. And I think initially I thought, well, that was the best that my brain could do when it was soaking in pus. That was about the best consciousness it could muster. Since then, of course, I've read a lot more, especially several thousand years worth of afterlife reporting, and it's not so clear-cut to me that I can simply say that was the best consciousness my brain could muster, soaking in pus. But suffice it to say that it seemed to last for a very long time. It was totally unresponsive. I could, even though I had no words at the time, I could wonder, you know, what, where, who. And there was never any blip of change in that realm to give me an answer. It was just this monotonous, ongoing, bubbling, foamy muck. And that was, you know, if I had somehow come back from that experience and then awakened in the ICU and come back to this world, I would have had what many people would call a hellish near-death experience. And in fact, my understanding now, and again, I think other people can comment on this better than I because they've studied hellish near-death experiences very much, like Nancy Evans Bush, but I think, in my view, that those are partial NDEs. In other words, people didn't go deep enough. Because for me, what happened next was, as I was kind of at the bottom of that earthworm eye view, this beautiful spinning melody just appeared out of nowhere. It was a beautiful white light, very fine white and gold filaments, and it had this lovely melody that came with it that was very attractive and beautiful as a piece of music, and it was totally different from that pounding, monotonous, mechanical sound that I'd heard for eons. And as that white light came closer to me, it opened up into this beautiful, heavenly gateway realm, and that was really the second major realm. Beautiful valley, very verdant, waterfalls into crystal pools, clouds up above that were kind of boiling white and colorful against dark blue and black sky, and these arcs of shimmering light orbs moving through that very high sky with these anthems coming down, just a really indescribably beautiful and very hyper-real scene. And on the wing of a butterfly with a beautiful girl and seeing what I called in my early writings villagers, I think these were souls down below us dancing. I still had no body image at all. I was simply a speck of awareness on the butterfly wing. And there was this beautiful girl whose loving and comforting thoughts went straight into my mind. She never said a word, but her thoughts, extremely comforting. You are loved. You are cherished. You will never be thrown away. There's nothing you can do wrong, and it's important to state, in that realm, nothing I could do wrong. There wasn't a general message of nothing you could do wrong in this realm, because when I was there, I didn't even know of the earthly realm. But very comforting, and then a warm, divine breeze blowing through that was my awareness of the divine, omniscient, omnipotent, creative source behind all of this loving, realm and then outside of this universe into the third realm, which I call the core, totally outside of higher dimensional space and time, with an orb of light, brilliant orb of light, and this divine, infinitely loving, unconditionally loving creator of it all. And that's where I was told, again, not in words, but the concepts, we will teach you many things, but you're not here to stay. You'll be going back. And then lessons all about the physical makeup of the universe, about the importance of love and how it's the fundamental constituent of all of existence at that highest level, and why evil exists as a trace impurity, and how we are loved so deeply so that we can manifest free will in this earthly realm. Time flow in that outer realm was completely different. There was access from the core into any part of our space-time, which explains so much about the eternity of our souls and about issues that some people have with reincarnation, which are much clearer and easier to see when one realizes that time flow in that outer realm is completely independent of this kind of slow molasses-like river of time that we have down in our earthly realm. And then I would find myself back in the earthworm eye view. And it was in that realm that I slowly learned again with this second exposure to it, and it was once again very unresponsive and monotonous and dull and underground and, you know, the earthworm's eye view. But I learned that by remembering the notes of the melody, I could spin that melody, that beautiful white light would appear and spin around slowly and then open up back into the gateway, into that verdant valley on the butterfly wing, millions of other butterflies, blossoming flowers, waterfalls, pools, and this beautiful girl beside me. I could remember her face so well. And then up outside into the core, outside of the universe, as the entire higher dimensional multiverse collapsed. And once again, you're not here to stay. You'll be going back. And then more lessons about all of reality and existence and about the eternity of our souls. And then I would find myself back in the earthworm eye view. And I describe this in my book in a lot more detail. The most striking feature, especially of that gateway and of the core, was the responsiveness, the way that very complex conceptual ideas and edifices of incredible complexity came into my awareness instantly, completely, no questions, absolutely. The lessons were the most amazing part of it all. And then again, of course, told that you'll be going back. And then finally, one day, that melody didn't work anymore, and I was unable to get back into the lovely heavenly gateway and the core.
And we won't get into it now, but people, when they read through Proof of Heaven, they might be surprised that you were able to identify that girl on the butterfly, which is extremely moving and significant. One thing I wanted to ask you, the messages that you kept getting or that you knew and through thought, and you described thoughts as being solid and immediate, with that you had this knowledge that you would be going back, but did you know where you were going to? I mean, your neocortex was not incapacitated. So where did you think you were going back to? Did you think you were going back to the underground existence, or were you cognizant of life in the physical?
That my assumption through the whole experience, after I'd cycled through one time and gone back to the earthworm eye view from that heavenly gateway and core, the assumption was that back meant back to the earthworm eye view. I never had a memory of the earthly realm while I was out there. And, you know, so in one sense, my near-death experience was not exactly like your kind of textbook case, even though all near-death experiences are different. There are some commonalities. And in my book, I explain how my meningitis was so effective at wiping out all of my knowledge of myself in the earthly realm that it enabled me to get a very kind of revealing set of lessons about that realm. It very clearly showed me the reality of that realm, and that it's not a hallucination, it's not a dream, it's not even something that happens in the brain. It's very real, and it happens in that spiritual realm, which is completely outside of the physical universe. And in my analysis, what I came to see is that although there were some atypical features of my NDE, which I attributed to the fact that I had a very severe case of bacterial meningitis, which inactivated the human part of my brain, the neocortex, those atypical features actually serve kind of like the exception that proves the rule. They serve to support and validate thousands or tens of thousands of reported near-death experiences in other people. And again, it allowed me to really focus as I was coming out of all this and writing it all up and trying to analyze it months later, to realize that those other NDEs are very powerful revelations about a realm that truly exists. And it's the realm of our conscious eternal spirit. And the fact that it does not happen in the brain and doesn't happen in the physical universe does not mean it's any less important. And in fact, given the sense of ultra-reality in that realm, which makes this earthly realm seem dreamlike by comparison, I would say that there are tremendous lessons to be learned by taking that realm seriously and understanding that, in fact, it is the divine realm of our eternal spiritual selves and really of the one consciousness that I think at the core we all are. For me, it was very much a beautiful demonstration of an all-loving, omniscient, omnipotent, creative deity that has been written about, by religious scholars and prophets for over 3,000 years. And the important thing to realize is that that realm is real, and that that deity is very real, and that all of our existence is based on that particular realm. And that's why it's important to learn much more about the afterlife literature and near-death experiences and what they tell us about consciousness and what they tell us about what many people would call God and that entire realm, which many people would say is heaven.
Right.
And this is also important.
You were told that there were many more universes than you could ever imagine, higher dimensions. But what was important was that at the core, at the center of all these dimensions was love. The only way to know these dimensions is to enter them and experience them directly. So do you think that perhaps it's our purpose in the physical to catch these glimpses of higher realms through love and compassion?
Well, to me, it was so clear. I remember as I was first kind of coming back and waking up, and my brain was very confused being back, trying to get its way working after a week in coma and after being so sick. The one thing that I knew absolutely at the very deepest level was that love was at the very core of this entire existence. And it was the love of that creator. And if I couldn't, as I said, my initial efforts were all about, a neuroscientific report about that hyperreal realm and trying to explain it on neuroscientific principles. And yet I kept knowing that I had to somehow explain the tremendous power of that love that I was that was really the fabric of all of existence at that deep level. Now, no question, in the in these lower dimensional spaces, evil, injustice, pain and suffering, those things are here. They're a very real part of this earthly realm, and there's a reason for that. Even though this realm is more dreamlike than the fundamental spiritual realm, this realm is very important. And when our soul and spirit is, you know, here in the body, incarnate in the physical realm, it's all about learning difficult lessons and making progress, kind of as our higher souls in that outer realm. But we're veiled from knowing all of that truth when we're down here. And that's what people glimpse behind in mystical experiences, including near-death experiences, is glimpsing behind that veil and realizing more of the ultimate nature of our existence. And in fact, I would say that as a neuroscientist with a long-standing interest in consciousness, my journey obviously caused me to completely question everything I'd always assumed about the brain generating consciousness, you know, brain giving rise to mind. Because what my journey told me is that, in fact, consciousness is much richer and more aware and more knowing when it's freed up from the limitations of the physical brain and, you know, the here and now, the time and space that we find ourselves kind of stuck in when we're down in an earthly incarnation.
Yeah, that certainly is a question that comes up quite often, and I'm sure people have asked you since the book was written. They say, well, if there are these other realms, you know, why do we have these physical restrictions? Why do our brains act as filters? You know, why aren't we given access to these other realms? So how do you answer that?
Well, I think, to me, the reason for our existence really has to do with our manifesting free will and making choices, making decisions down here in the earthly realm, where we are veiled and we don't have such a ready knowing of all that we come to know in that you know, the place where we are between lives or in near-death experiences, or can actually reach in deep meditation or in centering prayer or other mystical states, transcendental states, that kind of tend to thin the veil or let us peer behind the veil. But it has everything to do with our manifesting that unconditional love of the Creator, even here in this down and dirty world, the physical realm, earthly existence, you know, slowed down in the molasses-like river of time, and with all the evil and injustice and suffering that is present in this realm. And it has to do with our making the free will decisions that manifest that love for others and help us to learn the lessons of the hardships, challenges, and difficulties in our lives that allow our higher souls to ascend closer to a godlike nature in that outer realm. But that's why the veil is there. If we had ready knowledge of that higher realm and all of the principles and reasons for existence, and could see them as clearly as, say, the moon rising in the sky every night, then obviously the value of our free will decisions wouldn't be as great, because as it is, by being veiled, those decisions are made largely with our having faith that realm exists. And in fact, that's one of the things that I saw very clearly, was that unconditional love of that divine supreme being for each and every one of us knows that we can have solace and relief from some of the suffering, pain, and misery by having faith and knowing that we are loved and protected and that we will be taken care of. And that's part of that tremendous unconditional love of that deity for each and every one of us, is just knowing the pain that we feel if we lose track of our divine connection. And that is something that, unfortunately, is a very common situation in our modern secular world, where many people are kind of bought up into the materialistic thinking that the physical realm is the only thing that exists, and that when the body dies, that's the end of all. And in that world, it's very painful to go through a lot of what we have to go through in this life, which is much better tolerated if we know more of this spiritual realm and the eternity of our souls, and the fact that we are indeed loved very deeply and unconditionally by that creative deity.
Well, it's about as good as an explanation as I've heard, so that's wonderful. Brenda, you mentioned there was some people writing.
Yeah, we have a question on AIM that I'd like to share. This is from Kevin, and Kevin asks for your opinion on what we all can do to make ourselves as close as possible to God. In other words, what is your opinion of what we can do that would put us in harmony with what you have experienced?
Well, I think for me, the simplest thing is to lead a life that is filled with compassion and love for others. I find that I meditate daily, centering prayer, meditation through whatever mechanism, transcendental meditation. I just so happen to have encountered using various acoustic manipulations. One I originally got into was using HemiSync that was developed by Robert Monroe of the Monroe Institute, but there are definitely other ways of using music and various sound patterns to enhance deep meditative states. But it's very much about trying to turn off that voice of ego, the self, the voice, the human linguistic brain. I mean, the first thing I do in meditation is I can make an intention and ask for help and express gratitude, but then I just quiet that voice. And it, of course, that's the voice in my head that I spent all those years in medical school and in residency training and in neurosurgery. That little voice was getting educated all that time and putting together a worldview. And, of course, what I've come to realize is that there's a lot that you can learn through those words and that linguistic brain. But for some of this really deep knowledge about the reality of our existence, it's best to actually turn that little voice off. And so this is all about going deep into kind of a silent meditative world where we are reflective and able to have gratitude and appreciate our conscious existence. And I would suggest that, as much as people can learn, in books and presentations, watching DVDs, going to courses about this kind of existence and this kind of knowing, that at the end of the day, we each have to go into our own consciousness, because that's where those answers are. And they don't come from rational thinking and logic and trying to follow all that through. The deepest answers actually come from that kind of wordless knowledge that exists deep in those realms. And that's where I went in my NDE. The good news is you don't have to almost die to go there. All of us who own a consciousness, which I think would include all of your listeners, can go there. And it's through deep meditation, centering prayer, living a life of compassion and love for others, and taking that self, that ego, especially the one addicted to making gains in the material world, with a mindset of, there's only enough for a few of us to really have enough, so I'll hoard all mine. Well, that's not the right attitude to get into these deep states and get to be one with that deity. And I think we all can come to hear that very same voice that I encountered deep in my coma experience through meditation, centering prayer, and approaching life with a compassion and with love for others and with a gratitude that every breath we breathe is a gift.
Well, you know, as I listen to you, I almost have to chuckle because I keep picturing you listening to yourself 5 years ago and what you would have thought about what you were hearing. It just shows you, I mean, you would have thought some of these concepts were a complete contradiction in terms. When you talk about an ultra reality deep in coma and the scientists, the medical scientists, and you say, well, that, what are you talking about? And now you have all these insights, but it's all, you've turned it into a knowing based upon your experience. I mean, can we, this knowledge, can we reach this knowledge without having direct personal experience? I mean,
I would say very much. You know, as I said a minute ago, you don't have to almost die to get this. You don't have to have a near-death experience. But it does come from meditation, from centering prayer, from really turning off that ego, turning off the self, and also getting rid of that the little anxious voice in our head. I mean, neuroscientific studies revealed 40 years ago that little voice in our head, as much as we all, you know, tend to think using common sense, that that's the decision maker of our free will. And yet neuroscientific experiments, starting with Benjamin Libet and some of the other experiments done back in the 70s and 80s, showed that little voice is actually a spectator. And there are deeper parts of our mind and consciousness that are making decisions and that are really kind of manifesting the will of our spirit at a deeper level and a level that's not at all limited by the laws and rules of physical space and time.
And I know we're nearing the end of our time, but I did want to ask you, it was quite unusual while you were in coma, you had family members that were with you constantly. Somebody was always at your side, you know, holding your hand. And there were also many people that were sending out intention, healing energy, and praying for you. Do you think that contributed to your recovery?
Well, one thing I can say, and I definitely say this when I talk to doctors and nurses, is that prayer gets in. And I will advise medical and healthcare workers now, I don't care if you have a patient who is obtunded or in coma or brain dead or physically dead, best to assume that their awareness, their consciousness is around and paying attention in everything you say and do, because that's the case. And I think prayer is very powerful. There are studies that reveal that prayer can have a tremendous impact on someone's health and recovery. I hesitate to say that prayer is the reason I came back. I think that it helped me, gave me great comfort, and I explained this in my book, how I was, how the comfort of people praying was tremendous and very helpful to me, and it would have been very helpful to me even if I'd never come out of my coma. It was beautiful, and that love cannot be, overstated how important that is. But I would not go so far as to say that is the reason that I came back, because I think the reason I came back has more to do with a divine plan that I still do not fully understand and cannot explain, but I do think it happened for a reason. And I think I came back to help people understand from a neuroscientific and a philosophical point of view that our souls are eternal and that we have nothing to fear and that we are all deeply loved. And it makes a lot more sense to me now. And in my book, I go into transpersonal psychology and into the hard problem of consciousness and the enigma of quantum mechanics and how all of this supports very strongly that our consciousness is eternal and is not dependent on the physical brain.
Right.
In fact, to me, the biggest mystery is that no one on earth has the first sentence that explains how consciousness comes out of the physics, chemistry, and biology of the brain. And that's a tremendous clue as to the validity of my experience and millions of others reported in NDEs and spiritually transformative experiences.
And we have been talking with Dr. Eben Alexander. His new book, which is coming out in 2 weeks, is called Proof of Heaven, The Neurosurgeon's Near-Death Experience and Journey into the Afterlife. The website you can visit for more information is lifebeyonddeath.net. We thank you so much for being with us. We look forward to seeing you at the conference next month. And I think that this perfect storm of an experience that you had is really going to kickstart a movement that's been going on for quite a while. But you're raising so much awareness, and we're so appreciative that you're sharing it all with us. So take care, and thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you, Bob and Fran, and I look forward to seeing you in a few months.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
And now it's time for us to say,
our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.